My name is Dan Chodorkoff, and I am a co-founder and the director of the Institute for Social Ecology. I want to welcome everyone here to begin with. It's great to see a new crowd of people coming through the ISE. I'm scheduled to talk today about social ecology and its relationship to anarchism. My sense is then that I will talk in a fairly introductory way about social ecology, and then try to relate it to anarchism. And I have to say at the outset, I have to offer a caveat that it's a difficult task. Social ecology is a complex body of ideas. It's not something I can define for you in 25 words or less, or reduce to a bumper sticker. And relating it to anarchism is a Herculean task, because anarchism, of course, is all over the map, and it really depends on what kind of anarchism we're talking about in terms of its relationship to social ecology. Several people mentioned Murray Bookchin, and I think at the outset I have to acknowledge that Bookchin, who co-founded the Institute here with me, really is the seminal theorist of social ecology, and there is a particular social ecology associated with Bookchin, but that social ecology also exists in a broader and more generic sense. And I would also say from the outset that social ecology is very much a set of ideas that is still being formulated, that Bookchin has, I think, in a rather brilliant and comprehensive way, presented a general framework, but that there are certainly gaps in the theory. There are many areas that social ecology and a social ecological analysis can address that have not been fully fleshed out. I think actually a lot of the presentations here this weekend are going to be doing some of that fleshing out and development. And if you look at the program, you'll see that a number of the presenters here are people who are either associated with the Institute or students of social ecology. So clearly there is an affinity between social ecology and anarchism. I'll try to lay that out. And I'm going to have to be succinct. I wonder if is there anyone with a watch in this group? I see several, because I don't have one. And I guess we're to go only in. To go only. Could I? That would be. Thanks. I guess we're supposed to go until 12:15, which leaves us not much time. Excuse 12:45. Okay, that's a little more time. Good. Thanks. Well, social ecology is essentially an interdisciplinary perspective which addresses the central issue of people's relationship to the natural world, and it does so by drawing on studies in philosophy, anthropology, sociology, history, and the natural sciences, particularly the science of ecology. Social ecology, as I mentioned earlier, Bookchin social ecology, really is a comprehensive theory, and some critics have suggested it is the first such comprehensive theory since Marx that really tries to create a philosophical framework and grounding for our understanding of, first of all, what constitutes nature, what constitutes society, what constitutes community. There is an epistemological element in social ecology. From that epistemology, which also, and of course an epistemology is a way of knowing, a methodology that one can then extract an ethics from, and social ecology does have a particular ethics that it derives from our understanding of nature and people's relationship and society's relationship to nature. And then from that ethics, social ecology derives a politics, and it's also a very distinct politics. Social ecology operates within three temporal frameworks, three time frames. The first is, of course, the past. And social ecology understands the past not simply as history, but as a deeper, non-literate record of both the development of species on the planet, understands nature, in fact, as natural history, understands nature as an evolutionary process, not as a static set of relationships or phenomena, but understands that nature can only be defined when we really look at the whole of natural development, from unicellular organisms, you know, 3.5 billion years of biological evolution from unicellular organisms to the more complex life forms that interrelate today to create ecosystems of which humans are a part. Socially, and I'm being very succinct here, of course, 3.5 billion years of natural evolution in 2 minutes. Social ecology understands that nature has within it a tendency towards ever greater complexity and diversity, that the history of nature, the history of evolution, is not a steady movement. There are certainly peaks and valleys, and there are extinctions, and there are all kinds of cataclysmic events that occur in natural evolution, but that overall nature is best understood as a movement from simplicity to complexity, from very simple ecosystems and simple organisms to more complex organisms composed of a variety of diverse species. We understand natural history as an ongoing process. We understand that humanity and society are also embedded within natural history, that nature can be understood as this developmental process, and that we can mark certain points, not as hard and fast breaks, but certainly as gradual transitions within nature from what social ecology defines as first nature, which is essentially non-human nature, melding into and shading into second nature, which is human development and social development. That this evolutionary process is marked by ever-increasing stages of consciousness, awareness, and self-awareness, that ultimately natural evolution and second nature, or nature as manifested in human societies, holds the potential to be rendered self-conscious. Nature can become aware of itself, and that the development of human consciousness and awareness, scientific understanding, rationality, etc., is really a part of that process of nature becoming aware of itself, becoming self-conscious. And that suggests some rather profound things about the evolutionary project and the human prospect and the human potential. In terms of this deep past that social ecology examines, we also shift from natural history to an understanding of cultural evolution. And there is a very strong anthropological component in social ecology. My background is in cultural anthropology. I did my PhD in that. And that social ecology draws on this anthropological background to understand that human societies have been constituted in the past in ways that are in fact qualitatively different from the way human society is constituted today. And that the process of evolution, both in terms of natural evolution and cultural evolution, is really a cumulative process. It's a process in which nothing is lost, but rather layers of complexity are added on. So that if we understand, as anthropology does today, as almost all anthropologists would acknowledge, that there is no single immutable human nature, but rather a broad human potential, and that that human potential is represented and constituted by the whole totality of human experience, the whole of human history on the planet, then we understand that by looking at this anthropological record, by recognizing that people have had qualitatively different relationships with each other and qualitatively different relationships with the natural world, that constitutes a potentiality. And social ecology is very concerned with potentiality. It's very concerned with the possibilities that exist, looking at not simply what is, but what could be and what should be. And we draw inspiration from our understanding of these qualitatively different cultures that have existed over time. And it does represent a potential for us. And I want to be very clear here. This social ecology rejects the kind of neo-primitivist ideas that have gained a lot of currency in anarchist circles in recent years. We're not suggesting that we should return to a hunting and gathering lifestyle, that we could return or that we would want to return. But we can understand that the human potential is represented by those cultures. Offers us perhaps a set of principles that can be extracted dialectically transformed and applied in our own time. It offers us a degree of hope, the possibility that we can actually create societies which are qualitatively different from that which exists today. And I don't want to suggest to you that the human potential has been exhausted by its history, because undoubtedly there are aspects of our potentiality that have not, that have never been realized historically, haven't been realized in contemporary society, and might be realized in the future. So I hope I'm being clear. Usually I take several hours to cover this portion of social ecology's outlook. But that is the first time frame that social ecology draws on. It is this deep historical understanding of nature as natural history, of the evolutionary process, of change as being ongoing and constant. It's really a dialectical approach to understanding development. And I would emphasize once again the cumulative nature of that development too. Social ecology looks at nature and natural history and tries to understand certain developmental tendencies. And as I mentioned earlier, we do see a tendency towards ever greater complexity and diversity in terms of individual organisms and their developmental trajectory, and in terms of ecosystems, the interrelationships between organisms. We also recognize that in natural ecosystems, there is what we term unity in diversity, that the more diverse and complex an ecosystem, the greater the number of species interrelating in an ecosystem, the more unified and stable that ecosystem is. If you look at complex ecosystems like a rainforest ecosystem or an estuary ecosystem, you can see that a single species can be extracted from that. You know, you can have a dramatic decline without the whole system collapsing. On the other hand, when you look at very simple ecosystems that have small numbers of species interreacting, interrelating, any individual species decline can lead to a collapse of that whole system. So these are principles or tendencies that we see in the natural world that we try to extract from nature and that we use as a basis for developing an ethic that has ethical implications for society. If we understand humanity as a part of nature, second nature as an outgrowth of first nature, then we understand that these tendencies that apply in natural ecosystems also have application in society. And here I'd also be, I want to be very clear, very consciously, we avoid the language of natural law. These are tendencies in nature or principles that we can derive from our understanding and interpretation of nature, not immutable natural laws, because if you know anything of the history of natural law theory, you know that it's been used in horrendous ways to justify social Darwinism, to justify fascism. It's all of these totalitarian philosophies have also been grounded in nature, but it's in a view of nature as immutable natural law. It's a very arrogant attitude. We instead talk about tendencies or principles. Some other important tendencies or principles that we derive from our interpretation of first nature involve a understanding that in natural systems there are no hierarchies, that ecologists many years ago stopped talking about food chains and instead now talk about food webs, recognize interrelationships, that the idea of the example Bookchin uses is that the lion is the king of beasts is really a projection of our own social hierarchies onto the natural world. The lion does not command and control other species or even other individuals within a pride of lions. Rather, they are dependent on other species, and it is this web, this interdependency that is most characteristic of ecosystems. There are no real hierarchies. You can talk about the lowly ant, but if you know anything about rainforest ecology, you know that there are something on the order of 40 species of ants, and that they play a crucial role in decomposing all of that organic matter on the floor of the rainforest that provides the nutrient base for all of the other species. So they are by no means lowly or at an inferior position in some kind of natural hierarchy. And if you're really looking for hierarchies in nature, look at the blue-green algae in the ocean, which creates something like 80% of the oxygen on the planet and without which life as we know it could not survive. So this notion of non-hierarchy is something else that we derive from our understanding of nature. We also see within nature a high degree of mutualism and interdependence, that in fact that is the hallmark of an ecosystem. It is a series of interdependencies, and these complex relationships create a whole which is greater than the sum of the parts, and that interdependency is also a tendency, a principle that social ecology derives from its understanding of natural history. Another very important principle is the notion of homeostasis, that in ecosystems there is a constant flow of energy, constant flux, constant change, and yet ecosystems, when they are at their most mature, do maintain a kind of balance. But it's not a static balance, it's a dynamic balance, and that's really what homeostasis means, is dynamic balance. That's another principle that we derive from our understanding of nature. And we also see that spontaneity plays a very important role in the process of natural evolution and the development of ecosystems, and that spontaneity is yet another principle that we derive from nature. And then see how these ideas can be applied in relation to society. The second temporal level that social ecology operates on is the present. And here, social ecology really distinguishes itself from other ecological philosophies and ecological movements in the sense that we offer a critical perspective on contemporary society that goes far beyond what I would term environmentalism. And I'll give a quick example here, a contrast between an environmental point of view and a social ecological point of view. An environmentalist might look at a problem like acid rain and say, you know, which of course is the highly acidic rain that falls on the Adirondacks that derives from the particulate matter and the high sulfur coal being burned in the plants with the tall stacks in the Midwest and the prevailing winds blow the east. When it hits the Adirondacks, it falls as acid rain. An environmentalist says, oh, well, the problem is the emissions from the tall stacks, and the solution is to put scrubbers on those tall stacks and clean up the emissions. Social ecologist says, well, that may be a short-term solution, but really the problem is the centralized forms of energy production that require those huge generating facilities burning high sulfur coal with the tall stacks. And underlying that is, of course, the centralized and authoritarian economic system that is dependent on those centralized sources of energy. And underlying that, ultimately, as we trace it back, are the relationships of hierarchy and domination that inform our society. So if we are to achieve an ecological society, while short-term, yes, let's clean up the emissions, let's put scrubbers on the tall stacks, long-term, we have to look at the underlying structures that ultimately result in the acid rain. And that's what has to be changed. Social ecology understands that all so-called environmental problems are really social problems, that nature in and of itself does not create these problems, that they're a result of humans' interaction with nature and the result of the particular forms of economic and political domination that govern our lives today. So you're probably beginning to see already some parallels with certain kinds of anarchist thought as I lay this out. Now, also in terms of contemporary society, social ecology is very concerned not just with changing the underlying political and social and economic structures that create the ecological crisis, but also with looking at alternatives that can be developed and implemented today, so that we have a reconstructive or applied piece within social ecology that examines very carefully things like alternative technologies, alternative sources of energy, ecological forms of agriculture and food production, ecological forms of industrial production, et cetera, et cetera. But once again, these are framed not within the environmental or reformist perspective of, oh, let's just convert from fossil fuels to solar energy, but let's look at the potential that solar energy and wind power and hydropower have for decentralized, democratically controlled forms of energy. How can these alternative technologies be applied and developed in a new social setting in which communities can control them? So that's a very important aspect of social ecology's understanding of the present. And the third temporal framework that social ecology operates in is the future. And here it's very different from conventional ways of thinking about the future, which are largely rooted in futurism, which is a subset of systems theory, where essentially you look at what is and you extrapolate out into the future. You know, the classic example of this was the Limits to Growth study, which came out in the early 70s. There was a group of scientists over at Dartmouth College, actually, who did this report for the Club of Rome, and it was a computer model, and they said, oh, well, we're going to run out of oil in 20 years, and we're going to run out of aluminum in 30 years, et cetera. Just looking at what they knew about current stocks of these raw materials and current patterns of use, and then it's a simple extrapolation out from there. It's a mathematical process. Social ecology thinks about the future from a utopian perspective, by which I mean a way that transcends our given society and thinks in terms of what could be and what should be. Not utopistic, not the fantasy of cloud cuckoo land that one usually associates with utopia, but rather grounded in the real existing potentialities of today in our understanding of natural history, in our understanding of second nature, of cultural evolution, in our understanding of what constitutes the human potential, what realistically could be and what should be. And what should be, of course, is informed by our ethics, the ethics that we've derived from our interpretation of nature itself. You know, the word utopia really is in need of rehabilitation because it has become a pejorative term. It's used in a dismissive way almost exclusively today. Oh, that's utopian. You know, it's unrealistic. It could never happen. It's absurd. But if you look at the etymology of the word, it can be traced back to Sir Thomas More, who coined the term in 1515, used it as the title of his great book, Utopia. Not so great in terms of the utopia he projects, but a monumental work in the history of social thought, really. And he says there are two roots for the term, both from the Greek. One is the word autopia, which means no place. The other is the word utopia, which means the good place. And of course, it's no place which has become the dominant definition of utopia. But in social ecology, when we use the term, we're instead talking, of course, about the good place, what could be and what should be. What kind of a society can be created in the future that can help to reharmonize people's relationship with the natural world, that can embody an ethic that questions hierarchy and domination, that substitutes cooperation and mutualism for competition? What kind of society can we create in the future that will really allow for the unfolding of the human potential, the unfolding of each individual's potential and the unfolding of society's potential? So, you know, once again, I have to apologize because it's a very inadequate definition of social ecology. This is really, I've really just scratched the surface here. But we have very limited time. In fact, we have only 45 minutes left, and I want to make sure we have plenty of time for discussion. So I'll leave it at that. Social ecology, as we've developed it here at the Institute for Social Ecology, builds on Bookchin's ideas. Some people, you know, there is within Bookchin's notion of social ecology a very specific form of thinking that he advocates that he calls dialectical naturalism. It's an attempt to take the dialectical project of Hegel and Marx and to introduce into it a understanding of nature that they lack, to move out of the idealism of the Hegelian dialectic and to move away from the reductive scientism of the Marxian dialectic and instead to infuse dialectics, which is of course basically a form of processual thinking, with a more sophisticated naturalistic understanding based in modern science, based in our understanding of evolution and our interpretation of the evolutionary record and the process of natural history. Bookchin suggests that the ethics of social ecology can be derived objectively from our interpretation of nature. I'd say within the broader social ecology movement, there's tremendous debate around that question, whether in fact it is an objective ethics. Some people, myself included, derive an ethics from a much more existential kind of position. And the politics proposed by social ecology is a politics called libertarian municipalism, a very specific approach to political action, which calls for the creation of assemblies which will be functioned through direct democracy, neighborhood assemblies as the basic decision-making body for society, then confederated out from there into regional assemblies and continental assemblies and ultimately global assemblies. And there's a lot more to be said about all of these aspects of social ecology, but I want to paint the broad picture for you. So social ecologists are engaged in protests, in oppositional politics, in trying to prevent the ongoing destruction of the planet, very concerned around social issues as well as ecological issues. Social ecologists have been involved in the ecology movement really since its inception in its modern form in the late 60s. Bookchin wrote an essay in 1964 called Ecology and Revolutionary Thought, which was really the first attempt that I'm aware of to link ecological thinking with a revolutionary ethos and ethic and practice. Social ecologists have been very active in the anti-nuclear movement in the early and mid-70s, active in the ecofeminist movement in the late 70s. We actually here at the Institute taught the first courses in ecofeminism anywhere in North America. We actually thought we coined the term at that point. Later found out a French feminist had used it a few years earlier. Social ecologists have been very active in community development work in a number of communities around the nation and around the world. Social ecology has been very active in the alternative technology movement and the alternative agriculture movement. In the early 80s, we helped to bring the green movement to the United States. I'm sorry to say now, given the state of the green movement, but it seemed like a very promising development then. In 1984, we sponsored and organized the first gathering of Greens in North America that actually ultimately transformed itself into the Green Party that's running Ralph Nader for president now. We've been very active, of course, in the movement against globalization, very involved in the co-op movement, in creating various alternative social organizations and economic forms, and really generally trying to educate people around this body of ideas. So I think it's apparent, as I spoke, that there are many parallels with a particular kind of anarchism. But I have to say that as someone who's been identified, I've identified myself as an anarchist for 30-odd years now. As I look around the anarchist scene today, I'm very confused and I'm not sure I even know what anarchism is. There are so many permutations, so many interpretations, ranging, of course, from almost pure individualism to neo-primitivism to other forms that personally I find quite antithetical to the ideas of social ecology, that it's difficult to I think it's difficult to define anarchism today. But I think there is a particular tendency within anarchism that I would call social anarchism that does have some very clear connections to social ecology. And the social anarchist tradition is essentially an anarchism which is rooted in the ideals of socialism and democracy, direct democracy. It's a directly democratic form of socialism. And that's really what social ecology advocates, though it is within the context of communities and neighborhoods, as opposed to the social anarchism that found expression in anarcho-syndicalism, labor unions, etc. We're really concerned with where people live, and we see the community as the locus of action for social ecology and the locus of action for what I would consider to be the most profound expression of the anarchist ideas, the social anarchist ideas. It's probably most closely related to anarcho-communism, though there are some distinctions there too, certainly between the classic expressions of anarcho-communism, people like Kropotkin, and the ideas of social ecology. But still some clear parallels. I think we share with anarchism a concern with the deconstruction, both theoretically and actually, of relationships of hierarchy and domination. We share with social anarchism a concern with direct democracy and see that really as the only appropriate political expression of social ecology, directly democratic forms for decision making. We share with certain strands of anarchism an emphasis on the need for confederation, the idea, of course, that no community can exist as an isolate, but rather that communities need to come together with like-minded communities to create larger networks of association in order to meet economic needs, social needs, in order to be effective politically. We share with social anarchism a antagonism to the state, of course. The nation state is seen by social ecology, as by anarchism, as a inappropriate and illegitimate form of power over people. Social ecology shares with social anarchism a desire not to dissolve power per se, but to bring power back to a level where individuals and communities can begin to exercise it in a meaningful way. We share with certain forms of anarchism a desire to create a communal economic base. We are anti-capitalist, opposed to capitalism, social ecology, as are most forms or many forms of anarchism. We share with anarchism a concern for the individual and the individual's ability, hi honey, the individual's ability to exercise their potential to the fullest degree possible, and yet recognize that that individuality as opposed to individualism has to be embedded within a larger set of responsibilities, a community, that individuals don't exist as isolates any more than communities can exist as isolates. Social ecology also, I think, shares with anarchism an ethos. And here I think at its most generous, social ecology really recognizes, as does anarchism, that the desire for a new society will require a revolution, revolutionary action, an overthrow and a supplementation of the existing structures of command and control by democratically controlled communities. So very briefly, I guess, and I'll finish here, social ecology calls for a society which is decentralized, which is confederated, which is directly democratic, which is anti-capitalist or communistic, in a certain sense, though here social ecology talks about bringing the economy under community control, communalism, if you will, and that social ecology also calls for an ecological society, a society in which first nature and second nature are reharmonized, in which ultimately first nature can realize its potential and become nature rendered self-conscious, nature aware of itself. So I'll end there, and we'll open up the floor to discussion, comments, questions, whatever. I apologize that this was so truncated, and obviously there's a lot more to be said about all of this, but I wanted to present the broad parameters. Yeah.
Yes, you said social ecology.
Different things at different times. But basically what I envision is a movement which operates on three levels, which is both oppositional and alternative, that is engaged in the protest movements, that tries to stop nuclear power, that tries to stop globalization, that tries to stop the kind of brutality that we're seeing in Los Angeles and in Philadelphia, that stands for human rights, that is very much a part of the ongoing social movements of today, yet does not stop there, that then moves from opposition into the alternative realm, so that people are also active in forming cooperatives and creating study groups and creating various kinds of community, economic, and political organizations, and then ultimately moves into the political realm through creating a counterpower, through creating neighborhood assemblies, by taking existing forms of direct democracy, like here in Vermont, we still have town meeting government, infusing that with a much fuller content and constituting those neighborhood assemblies, town meetings, whatever kinds of community forums for direct democracy exist, and creating those as a counterpower, confederating with other like-minded communities, and then ultimately contesting with the state for power. And that's the basic kind of model that social ecologists operate within. So it's really a three-pronged attack. Yes?
You say you're against globalization.